Welcome to Rumike Talks podcast. I'm your host, Konstantin Starodetsky. This is a space where I interview professionals from the entertainment industry and discuss popular film-related topics with my co-host
and producing partner, Rumena Dinevska. Our goal is to help and motivate aspiring filmmakers to get their films made.
Enjoy. I'm thrilled to interview Barbara Williams today. Barbara Williams is an actor and writer known for White House Down, Thief of Hearts, and City of Hope. Apart from that, Barbara wrote music, participated in many activism events, and is an author of The Hope in Living, a memoir. Please welcome Barbara Williams.
Hi, hi, hi. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you. It's been a goal of mine to interview you because I've been very curious about your life journey, your acting career, and especially your adventures to an interesting and exotic places. Because every time I write to you or send you a message, you're somewhere in Amazonian forest or some other destination. So is there any discoveries that you made during your trips or any stories that you can share from one of those journeys?
I was in the Ecuadorian rainforest with a tribe called the Achuar. And we were just there, part of a delegation, trying to brainstorm on what would be best to benefit their community, you know, because they've really been devastated by the encroaching oil drilling and logging. And it's really impacted their lives in such a horrible, negative way. I'm part of this group called Artists for Amazonia. So, you know, I mean, big picture is we're trying to save the Amazon, which is kind of overwhelming. Before that, I was in the San Felipe, you know, in the Sea of Cortez, on the Sea Shepherd, the ship, trying to save a little porpoise called the vaquita, which is the most endangered mammal, marine mammal on Earth. At the time, there were only 15 left. And there are fishermen who fish this fish called the totoaba for their swim bladder. And they sell that swim bladder to markets overseas, and it fetches about $100,000. Anyway, so what happens is the porpoise is the bycatch. So they're trying to get this totoaba, and they catch this vaquita, and it's being driven to extinction. And they also catch, you know, birds and turtles, and it's really brutal. And the cartel has kind of taken over the little town. So it was very dangerous, having Molotov cocktails thrown at the ship and stuff like that. Lots of
That's
fun.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Most recently, I was in Alaska, just hiking, just enjoying the beautiful, beautiful nature there. Some of the most gorgeous paths and, you know, mountain paths that I've ever been on. And that was, you know, that kind of restores me. I'm a big nature girl.
How cold was there? What was the coldest temperature you experienced?
Oh, it wasn't cold because I was there the last week of August and it was perfect weather. It was, you know, the mosquitoes were gone. Everybody says, you know, they've got mosquitoes that will drive you insane. We didn't have that. It didn't rain, and the tourists were, you know, it wasn't so touristy. I avoided all the tourists anyway. I didn't take any tours or anything, just rented a car and found all the choice places to go. So, and, you know, I wanted to see the glaciers that are disappearing, you know, like I was saying, where's the whatever one glacier? And this guy said, wow, you can't call it a glacier anymore. There was a day, you know, it went on and told us what it was like 25 years ago, but it was still pretty spectacular.
Yeah, that's amazing. Because when I was young, I always was obsessed with those Jules Verne novels about traveling, or Saint-Exupéry, how he was flying over different unknown lands and discover things. And I definitely can see that spirit in you, the adventurer.
Yeah.
So let's talk about your acting journey. What is there a moment in your life that you remember when you decided that I'm gonna become an actress? What was that first action that you made towards your career that you feel like it was the beginning of your acting journey?
Go way, way back. When I guess I was 17 and I had quit school. I'd gone through a very low period in my life. I didn't know what I was going to do. We lived in this little town. You know, my dad was a logger. We were always moving. And a teacher who kind of believed in me brought me a play. And it was kind of like, what? What's this? Because I, you know, at school, I had played one of the witches in Macbeth, like a, you know, and it was like double, toil and trouble. And, you know, it was like lots of fun. But this was a play called Suddenly Last Summer by Tennessee Williams, Southern, you know, very, very foreign to me, you know, living in Canada. But I started to read it, and it just resonated with me. It was like the language and the suffering that this woman, I was playing Catherine, who's been, you know, confined in a mental institution because she's seen something that everybody wanted to shut her up. And she's being interviewed, you know, by the psychiatrist and her evil aunt. And I had all these long monologues, and it was just beautiful language. And you know, one of the sentences is, we're all God's children in a giant sandbox trying to spell God's name with the wrong alphabet blocks. And it just really just hit me. And I knew I could do this. You know, I had never really, you know, I never had acting lessons or anything like that, but I just inherently knew how to deliver these lines. And you know, and I'd quit school, so I was kind of like, you know, an outcast in the community. It was a little town. But our first performance was on the stage at my high school, and everybody was there, you know, and I just, the feeling, I was terribly nervous. But then when the play was over, and it was kind of like this cathartic experience because I had these monologues and I'd weep and, you know, just lose myself in the words. And then everybody standing, clapping for me. And it was like the first time I felt seen, you know, like I felt, wow, this is who I am. I'm telling them who I am with somebody else's words, you know? And so that was, yeah, that was the turning point for me. And then the play went on and we went to the Provincial Drama Festival and I won Best Actress for it. And so they said, well, you know, does the one of the judges said, well, you should go to theater school, get some training. So I applied for theater school and I lied because you had to have graduated from high school. Mm-hmm. And I lied and said I had because I'd only gone to 10th grade. I'm revealing these terrible things about myself. and my principal went along. Like, so what happened was I get the audition thinking, oh, they're going to find me out and kick me out of here, you know. And I do a monologue from Romeo and Juliet and from Suddenly Last Summer. And I remember the head of the school said, well, you should, maybe you should have a little comic piece in your back pocket. And then he looks and he says, oh, and I see you burned down your school. And I was like, what? And it's true. Our school had burned down. And he said, yes. So your principal says that you would have graduated last year, but all the records were destroyed in the fire. So that's how I got to go to theater school. And from there, And then I met a director there. I did Charlotte Corday in Murat Saad, and he was impressed. So he invited me to come join his theater company. And I was with a theater company for 5 years. So that's the beginning.
Wow. That's definitely an interesting start. So during the years of training, during the years of performing, especially the early years. What was one of your best investments in yourself as an actor? Was it class or even a book or a particular moment that was a valuable lesson that you would share with other aspiring actors?
One time during when I was at school, I was very, very shy. Like, I just felt more comfortable when I had somebody else's words. You know, that was just the way I was. I didn't have any confidence in my own ability to communicate with people. But we had to perform doing something we couldn't do. So, you know, some people who were absolutely tone deaf would sing. Some people would play the trumpet, you know, some 200-pound football player would do a little ballet dance or something. And I decided I would improvise. It was really just like, I don't know what to do, so I'm going to improvise. I'm going to get up there and just see what happens. And I was so terrified. Like, my knees were shaking, and I went, why did I do this? It's the most terrifying thing. And the first thing I did, I just played into that. I went, oh my God. And I just went, ah, and I fell over, you know, and everybody laughed. And so I sort of crawled up and I said, I really don't know what to say, but I'm, and I just exaggerated the feelings I had. And so it was a moment of being completely present on stage. And I think that's what you're always striving for. You know, and obviously you want to be able to do that with your lines. Yeah, I think just being present, accepting that you know the words, you know who you are, you know all that, and just being in the zone, you know? Mm-hmm. So that was really a fantastic experience for me.
Being present is a valuable skill, especially these days. Do you find it harder to be present right now as opposed to like when you were starting out, when you were living without the smartphones and social media and internet and things like that?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely more of a challenge to block things out. Like, now I'm doing something more solitary. I'm, you know, writing. And so that's a challenge for me, is to just not be distracted all the time. And your life just fills up with stuff. You know, it's like, and then you go, what did I do all day? It seems like I was going from one thing to the other. But really, what did I accomplish? And so just trying to block all the noise out and the chatter of things is quite challenging. But I don't have the same fears as I did when I was younger. So, you know, I'm not afraid to be myself in public or as much. I still have. I'm also a musician. I don't know if you knew that. So when I perform, you know, playing guitar, that's always kind of like the bellwether. That's like the barometer for my nervousness. If I can't pick the guitar, and it's when you're thinking you're thinking outside of yourself rather than being inside, you know, and just not like, obviously you want to have stage presence and acknowledge an audience, but not be so preoccupied with what they're thinking and how you're being received.
Let's talk a little bit about the music. When did it start? Did it start approximately the same time when you started acting or later?
No, it was earlier. I always thought I was, you know, I wanted to be a folk singer. I got a guitar when I was like 13 and taught myself and sang Hank Williams songs and, you know, then Joan Baez and Judy Collins and, you know, and so when I was 15, I was picking strawberries at the strawberry field, and it was like labor. It was hard work. And one night these girls and I snuck out and we went down the road to this pop festival, and I was sitting on a bale of hay. I mean, it was all very exotic to me, you know, smells of marijuana and, you know, women dancing topless. And it was, you know, the hippie days. It was really wild. And for a girl from a small town, this was like, whoa. And somebody says, play something, Joni. And this woman sitting on a bale of hay next to me picks up her guitar and sings Both Sides Now. And it was Joni Mitchell. And it was like, oh my God, I'd never heard a voice like that. I'd never seen guitar played like that. And instead of being inspired, it kind of made me think, well, I could never do that. You know, I, you know, it's just, it makes you feel, it's so humbling when you're in the presence of that kind of genius. But later on, I did play, I played Joan Baez in a play many years later. And it was, you know, it was a great experience. You know, I write songs, and actually right now, I've been working on a one-woman show that would be, you know, excerpts from my books. Because I've written, you know, I published one book and I have another one sort of in the oven. and that's what I, it would sort of be that story. Right now I just have to sort of call it because it's, you know, I don't want people to have to sit in the theater for 10 hours, but just have to edit it down. It would combine music, you know, and monologues.
And it's a live event, like theater performance,
yeah.
Right?
One.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's interesting. You're planning to do it in Los Angeles?
Los Angeles. I mean, it might make more sense. I've discussed this with other people, what, you know, who would like to be involved in producing. And, you know, some people think it would make more sense to premiere in Canada because that's, you know, where it all began. So I'm not thinking about that right now. I'm just thinking about, you know, the creative part of it.
Well, definitely send me a link later when the news is going to come, like when it's going to happen and where.
Right.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Back to acting. Let's talk about the mechanics and sort of business side of it, so to speak. How do you go from, oh, I want to be in a movie or in a TV show to, let's say, play the US vice president and flash forward or being a Thief of Hearts?
It's kind of like I didn't have any control over the casting of it. You know, it's just something that came to me. With Thief of Hearts, I was new to Hollywood, you know, followed a man down here. And I was actually at a birthday party for somebody. It was a very un-Hollywood event. And there was a casting director there, and she said, are you an actress? And I said, yes. And she invited me to come do a reading, and she liked my reading. So then she invited me to come audition for the producers and director. And I did that, and I was staying with a friend. I'd done a film before that. I'd done a film in Israel and done a few TV things in Canada. And I'd done a film, but you know, they were all sort of very small films. I think I did a, you know, pretty convincing audition, and so then it was a screen test, and that was a big big deal. I aced it. And, but I was still, you know, I didn't have a green card. I was living down here, sort of entering the country, you know, a little surreptitiously. but so I had to go back to Canada and apply, you know, so what happened was the studio had to, apply for a work permit for me. And that was a big deal. That was kind of like one of the biggest hurdles, you know. Now I think it's even more difficult. But so I was just waiting on tenterhooks to hear if I was approved for, because, you know, with a situation like that, it has to be, well, this is the only person who can do it. So, you know, the director said, well, you know, we auditioned thousands of actresses and blah, 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 you know. So it came through. And then, you know, the nightmare of shooting began. But I mean, it was kind of like trial by fire. I'd never done a film with such high stakes, and it was a studio film, and it was Bruckheimer Simpson, and a lot of pressure, and it was, you know, not a, it was a learning experience. I wish I knew then what I know now, which is, I think, the refrain of many actors, you know. I wish I'd been more prepared for what I was going into. But c'est la vie, you have to sort of accept that.
So if you would give an advice to your younger self, if you start doing through the same motions again, going to auditions, finding an agent, or other things related to finding a role in a movie or in a TV show, what advice would you give?
You know, it's hard because everything seems so random with me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I'm the best person to give advice to anyone. Mm-hmm. I would just say be serious about what you're doing. Find some kind of showcase for yourself. Do a mm-hmm. film, you know, and now people have so many tools available to them as well. You know, wasn't that those things weren't available when I was younger. You can shoot a film on an iPhone, you know. But
yeah.
And or do a stage production, and you know, and there are casting directors who will come to plays, and you know, so always be prepared. You know, take classes. Mm-hmm. You never know when an opportunity is going to arise, and you should just be prepared at any time. And it can really wear you down because those opportunities don't come up that often, and there's a lot of competition, a lot of competition. So. Enjoy the process. Don't always be thinking about the end result because, you know, if you're always thinking about how, and again, I'm going back to, you know, the first lesson I learned, how, what are they thinking of me? What are they, you know, get that out of your mind. Enjoy the process. When you go into an audition, don't be trying to please. Be authentically in that character, you know, mm-hmm. and enjoy it. That's part of the, you know, everybody kind of goes, well, this doesn't matter. It's like not till you get the role. And obviously when you get the role, it's much psychologically, it's much easier to own it. Say when you get an audition, okay, now I own the role, you know, I walk in as if this is mine,
mm-hmm.
you know, that kind of confidence, that kind of poise really resonates with people. I can't say that I possessed it at an early age. That's another thing I wish that I knew more about that. And also when you're learning a role, to not jump into the end before you have it down technically. You know, you should always dissect something piecemeal by the, you know, find the foundation first. Like when you're learning lines, just learn the lines. Don't overlay character or anything that will come. First of all, learn your lines, and then, you know, develop the character alongside that so that you're technically prepared, psychologically prepared, and then when the time comes to deliver, those things come mm-hmm. together.
Is there a particular film shoot that you remember or a story from filming something or even from a theater place that you'd like to share, something that you keep coming back to?
Well, I did tell you about my experience playing Joan Baez
mm-hmm.
and with Joni Mitchell. And Joni Mitchell came to a performance and I had one scene where I am my husband, who the play was based on a book he wrote. He was a conscientious objector, and he went to prison rather than go to Vietnam, to the Vietnam War. Mm. And so Joni Mitchell is like my idol. I just, you know, she's it. And I have to open the play singing and playing guitar, knowing that she's back there and like there's this golden aura around her. I got through it. And I just went, you know, that's what rehearsal's all about. You just have this muscle memory. You do it even in spite of, you know, you could be in a snowstorm. You could be in front of 100,000 people. You could be in front of 10 people. Your muscle memory is what's most important. And at one point, my husband comes on stage. He's being taken to prison. And he says, you know, he's going to leave. And I say, I feel like I've let you down. And he says, no, you're the noblest spirit of them all. You're what's held me up. And Joni Mitchell, I hear, ha, that's from the theater. And I'm like, whoa. And I keep doing this scene and she starts laughing. And it's like, and it's a serious scene. And I'm just dying. And then I have to sing a song, Swing Low, Sweet Chariot, as my husband's being taken away to prison. And Joni Mitchell is laughing. And I have to say, it's like, I'm not telling you a high point of my career. I'm telling you, this was like the most humiliating moment of my life on stage. And I just, you know, I wanted to just never go back on the boards again. And then a couple of years later, I was at a Vanity Fair party for the Oscars. And I hear, I'm just wondering why I'm there. I just came with my husband because he was a politician, so he used to get invited to these events. And I hear, I owe you an apology. And I turn and it's Joni Mitchell. And she apologized to me. And she didn't have a great relationship with Joan Baez, so she was telling me, you know, she said, well, when I came to that play, I said, I told the producer, if you make Joan Baez a saint, I'll protest. And that's what she did. So it was a difficult moment for me. Anyway,
yeah.
That's a very memorable, I write about that in my book, actually, so. Mm-hmm. I'm giving you a little preview. You know, when I did City of Hope, that's actually one of my most favorite roles, working for John Sayles. He's a wonderful director, and it's a very, you just feel like everybody's the same. It's very much a collective, you know. My first husband, because it was before I was married to my last husband, I've been married twice. My husband had just left me for another woman, like the day before I was leaving. And I was just in tears all the time. I was shooting in Cincinnati. And I just had to use it. And I was just a puddle of tears all the time. But then it ended up really working for me in this role, you know, so... Mm-hmm. It might have been different if I had been in a really happy place in my life, but it kind of worked for me because I was playing a woman who had been through a lot.
Would you say it helped you, that role helped you to kind of overcome that period, that moment in your life?
I don't know. Yeah. Sometimes, you know, as actors, we get this, it's an insight I've had, and when I see other people who don't express their trauma or express, you know, emotions well, what you keep inside, you know, there's this St. Thomas quote, if you bring what's inside out, what you bring out will make you well. If you keep what's inside, it will destroy you. And I think that's, you know, one of the things that keeps us, I don't know, it's one of the benefits definitely of being an actor. It's healthy to express. And, you know, sometimes people can be a little bit, you know, self-absorbed and, you know, sometimes I feel like doing this interview, I feel a little self-absorbed. I'm just talking about me, me, me. But,
well, that's the interview about you. That's where you get to talk about yourself all you want.
but you know, I mean, and I think that's why, like, I also feel to counter that, to, you know, that's why I feel compelled to do environmental work and, you know, give what I can, not only as an artist, but, you know, just in terms of bringing awareness to bad situations around the world.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about your activism side, portion of your life. As I saw, you met Dalai Lama. At least I saw a picture with him. I've read that you've been arrested for your activism work. And that's a lot already. So would you mind sharing?
My father was a logger. So, you know, I grew up like in communities, logging communities, and we were always moving. It was a very sort of unstable life. And then I was working in, you know, as long after I'd come here and established myself as an actress. And then I was doing a film on Vancouver Island. That's where I was born. I was born on a tugboat coming into a place called Esperanza Harbor. I decided on my birthday, I took a break from filming and I chartered a plane and I flew up with my boyfriend at the time. We were in this little plane, you know, and we were flying over the island and I started to see these big swaths of denuded hillsides and, you know, these mudslides sliding into the ocean and just, it was these ugly, ugly scars. When I was a young person, I loved it when the trees got cleared because the sun would come in, you know, and it, like the forest just seemed infinite. But seeing it from this vantage point, I saw how finite the forest was. And it really, really affected me. And then Tom proposed to me when we were flying over. And I was actually totally motion sick. And I said we had to land, make an emergency landing so I could throw up. And I, but, you know, and then we went to my birthplace and it was a strange little missionary camp. But then I decided after that I got involved in trying to stop clear cutting. And it was, you know, going against my father's, you know, work. But it really, you know, and then I just started to educate myself on how important the rainforest of Canada was, and temperate rainforest, and, you know, how the decimation of our trees was really affecting the climate. So we got married. I decided I wanted to get married in the rainforest up in Canada, the temperate rainforest. And then the next day I stood on a blockade, the biggest mass protest in Canadian history, I think, to that date anyway. And so I got arrested there. And then down here I chained myself to the GTE headquarters to protest them using pulp from old growth trees to make yellow pages, which is just, you know, such a wasteful thing. They still make them, you know, but so I got arrested for that. And then I got more involved in, after I went to the Amazon, I went to the first Earth Summit in Rio. That was, you know, kind of a turning point. And I met a woman who started this thing called Amazon Watch, an organization. And so more recently, I got involved in the effort to save the Amazon. That's mostly what I'm involved in, but I did. And then I've done flyovers of the tar sands of Alberta. I went with Jane Fonda and, you know, trying to bring awareness to what's happening with the tar sands, which is the most dirty, most uneconomical extraction of oil. But it's, you know, big, big business. Then years later, we went to Minnesota because they're coming through Anishinaabe territory where they grow wild rice and the pipeline would go under the lakes. And these pipelines always, always leak. And the indigenous people there are dependent. This is part of their lifestyle, is the wild rice. And it's unique to that area only. And Jane, you know, she's, Jane is just a trooper. She's out there constantly. She, when she was doing her fire drill Fridays, she was getting arrested every week and encouraging other people to get arrested. You know, she was in DC and then she came back here and did it for a while. And then she was, you know, she went on, she was doing them online during COVID. I've been involved with a lot of her activism, and I had an event for her. Because she's raising money for candidates who are progressive on the environment. And it's called, I think it's the Jane Climate Pack. I think that you can, janepack.com, little pitch of people. So that's my main thing. I just think the earth is so amazing. We have to do what we can to preserve it.
And is this this work led you to meet Dalai Lama, or was it a separate?
Dalai Lama, I only met him once. We did meet in Rio. He was there and spoke through an interpreter. And then I just met him up here. Tom was giving him some kind of proclamation from the California Senate. Mm-hmm. And I remember it was, you know, for his environmentalism, and, you know, we had a private audience with him. And, you know, I was thinking, like, this man, you know, because he lives this life of simplicity, right, except he's always traveling around. And we had to speak through an interpreter. And so I asked him, I said, what do you do with, you know, these proclamations and these awards you get, because it's a big framed document? And he was so cute. He's so adorable. He just goes, I give them all away. So he answered in English, like he understood me, you know. It's like,
that's amazing. Let's talk about your book, The Hope in Living, a memoir. How do you go from an idea of writing the book to actually holding your first printed book in your hand with Jane Fonda blurb on it?
I've always been writing, you know, and I write songs, and I have journals forever. It just, that was one of the things that was something I started doing at a very early age. And then I started doing a writing class, and I was actually writing a screenplay at the time. I went to this writing class, and then it wasn't the most useful thing, this class for writing a screenplay. So I just started writing. It was really about journal writing, and it was called method writing, which kind of like approaching writing like an actor. So you would find your character, which is yourself, right? And writing as you speak, which is, you know, the biggest challenge of all as a writer, to really find your own voice. And so I would just write, and when you do that, you finding the deep voice, you know, so there, you know, you have the head, you have the heart, and then you have, or chest, and then you have the gut. So really being able to go into that deep place as a writer. This is a writing teacher named Jack Grapes. He's fantastic, fantastic teacher. I've turned so many people on to him. I had, you know, compiled a lot of stories about my past and, you know, my family. And one day I was with this woman. We were actually going to go see a play. She was asking me about my background. And she was from a very, very wealthy upper class family. And she had kind of made those assumptions about me, and I started to tell her, and she was involved in publishing as well. And I started to tell her, that's not my story at all. I started to talk about growing up in logging camps and moving around from place to place. She was just fascinated. So she said, have you ever written anything? And I went, yeah, I've written quite a bit. You know, they were all just individual little stories, you know, because you just write a few pages for each class. So I sent some to her, and she called me back and she said, well, this has to be a book, and I want you, you know, and she just introduced me to a few people who gave me some advice on, you know, finding the narrative through line to sort of make it a, you know, cohesive story. And then I just submitted it to a publisher, and I didn't hear from him right away. And I just was, you know, I got cold feet, and I thought, oh, well, he doesn't like it. And my husband kept saying, you know, call him up, you know, do, you know, approach him again. And it turned out, you know, it had just been lost in the mail. And then a week later, he emailed me and said, you know, I didn't want to like this because it's a difficult story to tell. You know, it's a difficult book to really publish. But one of the editors in his publishing house just loved the story, and she was just committed to it. And she said if he didn't publish it, she was going to take it to another publisher. So that was, I just really lucked out with that. And she was a great editor and, you know, gave me, you know, she didn't change it. I think what she was most impressed with was my story and my voice. It was just, it needed to be edited down and shaped a little more. So that was that, you know, and I sent it out to some people I knew, you know, sent out the manuscript, the galleys. And yeah, I got blurbs from, you know, some notable people. And c'est la vie, that was it. It was also during a time my husband was very ill, so it was difficult when the book actually came out. My husband was sort of in his last days, and I was doing a book tour, but I couldn't be gone for very long, so I was going back and forth. So it was kind of, you know, bittersweet because I was going through that whole trauma. And the book was longer. The manuscript that I submitted was actually much longer than the book that was published. So that's where I began with my next book. I, you know, I had like half a book that I started from. And so it's kind of, my next book is a continuation because that, my first book ended when I was 24. And that was a long time ago. So.
Well, I'm going to put the link to this book in the show notes so everyone can grab a copy.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much.
Of course. Now we are close to the end of this interview, and this is the question that I ask every guest who comes.
Uh-oh.
Here it goes. If you were an extraterrestrial from a perfect world where everything is in harmony, and now you visit our world where with all of its issues, what would be one thing that you'd fix?
I would zap Donald Trump. I would take him out of the universe. I'd take him to another place. I just think, yeah, I think that. I think I would, if I had the power of mind control, I would make everybody turn to the mountains and the oceans and the lakes and rivers and embrace nature if I had the power to do that.
That's a good one.
Okay.
And the final question of the episode that I end every episode, it's called Obsession of the Week. It's something that you've been obsessed this past week. It could be anything, a book, a movie, a podcast, some random thing. Like for me, this week, my obsession was matcha latte. I started drinking matcha latte more often. Is there something that you could share?
Well, I just saw Wim Wenders' film, Perfect Days. And, you know, it was kind
of, the Oscar nominee.
Yeah, I kind of, you know, it's very meditative. And, you know, you go in and you expect to be entertained or something. It's very repetitive and, you know, it's, you know, just about this very humble man who's a janitor, you know, he cleans toilets. And I was going, like, I was sitting there and I just kept shifting around and, like, and, you know, when music came on, it was like, oh, finally music. And I realized that It's actually brilliant. You know, it's beautiful. And he wrote it in, 4 weeks and shot it in 16 days. And just, it was almost like, guerrilla filmmaking, and actually going into these toilets of Tokyo. And so that was kind of, I keep reflecting on that. Like, it keeps the wisdom in it keeps coming to me in waves.
Just before the interview, talking to my wife about this movie, that we must watch this one. Well, thank you, Barbara, for coming today.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Rumike Talks podcast. You can find the show notes at rumike.com. I'm your host, Konstantin Staradetsky. My producing partner, Rumena Dinevska. See ya.